Well, you should have at your table, you should have a handout for the Bible lesson this morning, and it looks something like this. It has some questions on the back. It says, investing in individuals on the front. And this morning, we're going to look at some Bible passages. So I hope you have your Bible with you today. If you don't, I'm sure someone else at the table has a Bible, and you can share and you can look at these scriptures. What we're looking at today is how Jesus, in his ministry here on earth, took time to invest in individual lives. And it's very true that Jesus ministered to crowds. Many times in the Gospels, you read about Jesus preaching to crowds, teaching the multitudes, even performing miracles on behalf of a crowd. Can you remember a time that Jesus preached to a crowd? Anyone? A large group? Yes? In particular? Sermon on the Mount? Okay, sure. Yeah, we read about that, the multitudes coming together, Jesus teaching a large crowd and the Sermon on the Mount. How about a time that Jesus performed a miracle on behalf of a big group? Do you remember a time like that? Feeding of the 5,000? Right, Jesus performed a miracle, fed a group of many, many thousands of people. But even though Jesus did not avoid the crowds, he certainly ministered to the crowds over and over and over again. As we read the story of the life of Christ in the Gospels, we see Jesus focusing on individuals. Sometimes, even when he's ministering to a crowd or in the middle of a crowd, Jesus stops. He focuses on an individual. He really takes time to invest in a person. And that's heartwarming, and I think that's a challenge for all of us, too. In the busyness of our lives, we have many things going on. And as we study these Bible passages, we'll see that Jesus had plans. He had things he was seeking to accomplish. But so heartwarming that Jesus was not here on earth to build bigger and bigger and bigger crowds. In fact, he narrowed his focus. We read in the Bible when Jesus had hundreds of followers following him, listening to him, the Bible describes that he took an entire night in prayer by himself, and then the next morning he called all of those followers together, and what did he do? He selected 12 individuals that they could be with him and learn from him. And he focused on those 12 disciples. We know about that. Well, let's look at the Bible here. Let's look at these scriptures. Starting in Mark chapter 10, Jesus ministered to individuals, it says on your sheet. I suppose this is where I'm meant to stand this morning, but I feel so far away. Mark chapter 10. Okay, here's a story about Jesus in the middle of a crowd, focusing on an individual. So I'll read this, and you can follow along in your Bible. Verse 46, John 10, verse 46. And they came to Jericho. And referring to Jesus and his disciples traveling to Jericho from a region called Perea, which is a little to the east of what we think of as Israel, crossing the Jordan River, going through Jericho. And as he went out of Jericho with his disciples, it says a great number of people going along, following him. And they're headed toward Jerusalem at this point. So I think the meaning of the text is that the multitudes are actually traveling with Jesus, following him to Jerusalem, just ahead of the Passover feast at that time. And here's what happens. Blind Bartimaeus, the son of Timaeus, sat by the highway side begging. And when he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to cry out and to say, Jesus, thou son of David, have mercy on me. And many charged him that he should hold his peace. That means be quiet. So many people in this group said, be quiet. Don't yell so much. Too much noise. But he cried the more a great deal. Thou son of David, have mercy on me. And what did Jesus do? Verse 49, and Jesus stood still and commanded him to be called. And they called the blind man, saying unto him, be of good comfort, rise, he calleth thee. And he, Bartimaeus, casting away his garment, rose and came to Jesus. And Jesus answered and said unto him, What wilt thou that I should do unto thee? The blind man said unto him, Lord, that I might receive my sight. And Jesus said unto him, Go thy way, thy faith hath made thee whole. And immediately he received his sight and followed Jesus in the way. Now the sheet you have is really generic, just some general outline points, but I want to ask you this morning some specific questions, and I really encourage you to meditate and to reply, and let's all join in this Bible study together. And after we get through each section, I'll ask you what we can learn in our lives as we seek to minister to individuals. What can we learn from these examples here? So first of all, in Mark chapter 10, you see a clear distinction between the crowd and the individual. It's almost as if Mark is highlighting this for us. There's the crowd, and then there's the individual person. Let me ask you this. What was the response of the crowd to the individual being the blind man, Bartimaeus? How did the crowd respond to him? They thought he was in the way. They said what? Yeah, they said, hold thy peace, be quiet. You're bothering us. You are spoiling our parade. And this, I don't know, it's my imagination, but I picture that this is kind of what's happening. There's a big procession. Jesus.
That's generally how they treated handicapped person.
You know, the impression that I get is yes, that in those days, a handicapped individual was considered maybe of a lesser class. And you see that even in John chapter 9 when Jesus encountered another man who was born blind, as the scripture says. And his disciples, the spiritual bunch, they said to Jesus, somebody must have sinned because look, he's cursed. You know, he's blind. So who sinned? Did he sin or did his parents sin? Somebody must have sinned if he's blind. So I think yes, I think that's an excellent question. The society in general probably looking down on Bartimaeus and in general feeling like he's in the way. You know, he's too loud, he's getting in the way of our procession, he's a problem. So that's my first observation from this story. You see how the crowd responds to the individual. They feel like he's spoiling the event. Okay, let me ask you this then. How did the individual respond to the crowd? Bartimaeus, the blind man, how did he respond to them? I'm sorry, a lot of people are replying, and I love it, and I'm glad, but I can't hear what you're saying. Yes.
He was desperate.
Right.
He kept yelling louder.
Kept on. Yeah, that's good. Isn't that good? He's not embarrassed. He says, look, I'm blind. What do I have to lose? You know, I need help. And this is Jesus. He couldn't see him, right? But he heard the noise and he heard the procession and somebody said something about Jesus of Nazareth and he heard this is who it is. He said, I've got to get a hold of Jesus. I don't have another option. So whether the crowd's upset with me or not. And, you know, he was probably used to that. Used to people being upset with him or kicking him or abusing him in some way. He said, I don't care. I've got to get some help. So he just kept on. He needed an individual contact with Jesus. It was not going to work for him just to be satisfied with being part of the crowd. Do you understand what I mean?
Nothing was going to happen for him.
Nothing was going to happen, yeah. He had to have a personal contact. If Jesus doesn't stop and help me personally, tomorrow is going to be just like today and every other day. So he keeps on crying out. He's desperate. He wants to get a hold of Jesus. Okay, So we see Jesus' response. Jesus does stop. Jesus does help him. Now I want to ask you this. How is that a sacrifice for Jesus? How could we view it as a sacrifice on his behalf? Mm-hmm. He took time out of what he was doing. Do you know what Jesus is doing right here? Maybe you don't. I'm happy to talk about it, but maybe you do. Where is Jesus going? Where's he going to? Where's he traveling to? He's going through Jericho, but he's en route. He's on his way to Jerusalem. That's right. And what is going to happen in Jerusalem? In just a couple of weeks, the crucifixion, yes. Jesus is on his way, intentionally, from the region of Perea, traveling through Jericho on his way to Jerusalem. He's got a mission. I mean, he's on his way to fulfill the mission that he's been placed on earth for. You understand what I mean? I mean, this is a big picture event. He's doing what he's supposed to do. And all these people are crowding around him, and I don't know that that matters so much, but Jesus has a plan, and God has a plan, and he's on his way to do something big. And I love the example there. How often does it happen in our lives that we have plans and the plans get interrupted? And I'm not saying that your plans are bad plans, but you've got plans for the day and you have things that need to be done. And as I talk, you have to understand, I'm reminding myself as well as everybody else, we're doing good things. I'm not accusing anybody here of having selfish plans or worldly plans. We're trying to do things for the Lord and then we get interrupted. But God knows about that. And Jesus knows about that. His plans here are being interrupted. And he still stops and he still invests in the individual. Now that's my observation. From this particular story, I guess that's just what strikes me. There's a bigger plan at stake. You okay? All set? Okay, good.
And also it seems like the crowd would only get bigger if he stopped. You know, he's trying to keep moving, and if he stopped, then the crowd would only get bigger and start pressing.
Sure, yeah, more distractions, more problems, right? Well, that's how we have to guard our thinking. Interruptions are not necessarily problems, especially if there's a person involved. And it's surprising. It's actually surprising to me how often that happens. It happens frequently. Frequently. I guess I was challenged this morning because while I was in the middle of preparing this lesson so I could come in and teach, I had what might be considered an interruption for an hour to be able to talk to an individual. Well, you could look at that as an interruption or you could look at it as an opportunity. You see what I mean? Okay, so we can't be so focused on got to get things done that we can't stop, especially in ministry. I have the privilege of, I mean, my regular job is ministry, but it's ironic. It's funny how often we get going in ministry and we've got ministry plans and we can't stop for people. You know, I can't stop to help this person because I'm doing ministry. And of course, that's not a good perspective. Okay, well, any other thoughts before we go on to another passage? Observations you have by thinking about Bartimaeus? It's a beautiful picture. I mean, what was he doing before? He had nowhere to go. He couldn't be involved in exuberant activities like this, following Jesus from Jericho to Jerusalem, which incidentally was a rocky and very steep road. By the way, the road that they're about to travel on is the very road that Jesus talked about in the parable of the Good Samaritan. When there was a traveler traveling from Jerusalem to Jericho, He was robbed by some thieves on that path. So anyway, the point is, as a blind man, he would not have been able to make that trip. Well, now he's been healed, and what does he do? How does he respond? He certainly doesn't go back to begging, does he? No. And he's not crying out for help anymore. No, he says, I don't have any other plans for today. I was going to be just sitting there begging. I think I'll follow Jesus. It's a great picture.
I was going to say that. I've talked to Jim Cutfus about Peru, and he says in Peru, they think that if anyone is handicapped, who sinned? You or your mother? It's a very common thing.
Yes.
I know that's a certain sect of religion, or if that's just an ancient way of looking at things.
I don't know that it specifically has to do with religion, but yes, I've visited the ministry there, and that is in fact how that ministry got started, because years ago, the preacher and his wife, who were there attempting to reach hearing people, someone just came and dropped off two babies on their doorstep and just left them there because they were deaf. And they didn't want them. Yeah, right. They just left the babies there. So that's how the whole, now they have a ministry that reaches out to the deaf in particular. And it's grown over the years, but that is exactly the attitude that many of these children that they have in their home, nobody wants them. It's very sad.
Well, I always think of that when I see that. I think, you know, who sent you or your mother or your father?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't even realize there were places that did that in this era, you know.
Yeah, and it's a generalization. Not everyone thinks that.
Uh-huh.
Not every person, but yeah, maybe society in general. Yeah, probably. Good. Any other thoughts? Yes, ma'am.
I was going to say, in the agrarian culture, it would seem like, hey, you can't plow the field, you can't even walk around.
Right.
It'd be really hard.
Right, yeah.
That's probably even quite as hard in our culture, because you have, you know, you have very, very limited jobs. You could do something like, you know, telephone operator or something.
Sure.
It's probably one of the hardest disabilities to be blind, you know.
I would think, yeah, that's... And people may have viewed him as a liability, and Jesus did not. So, yeah, there's a lesson for us. Perhaps take time for those people that we personally wouldn't be eager to spend time with. Maybe we don't have a personal reaction against a disabled person, but maybe we have a reaction against some other kind of a person. Some person that we just don't think is likely to be a success. And that's the person, the very person, we need to spend time with. Well, should we go on? The second passage, I'm going to call an audible on this second passage here. John 5, is it, that's on your sheet? Yeah, let's go to John 8. Do y'all know what it means, call an audible? Any football fans in here? Okay, a couple people. Call an audible. That means we're going to change the play right in the middle of the play. So I want to look at John 8, actually, instead of John 5 today, just because. So John chapter 8, starting right at the beginning of the chapter, and I'll ask you for your input on this story as well. Okay, another story about the crowds, and also an individual, all in the same place. It says, Jesus went unto the Mount of Olives. The Mount of Olives, right by the city of Jerusalem, right by the eastern gate. And early in the morning, he came again into the temple. So picture the scene. There they are in the center of their religion. And all the people came unto him, and he sat down and taught them. Probably in a courtyard that they called the Court of the Gentiles. Back in those days, there was a very large outer court around the temple proper. They called it the Court of the Gentiles. And so you have to picture the scene in your imagination. Hundreds of people sitting around in the temple, the place of worship. Jesus is teaching all of them. Verse 3, and the scribes and Pharisees. Now we know these people. They appear so often in the Gospels and always in a negative way. They're always opposed to Jesus. So they're the religious leaders of the people. In their house, if you will. I mean, the temple is their place of business. They feel very much at home in the temple. They feel like they own the place. And the scribes and Pharisees brought unto him a woman taken in adultery. And when they had set her in the midst, for our lesson this morning, in the midst is a key phrase. In the midst of what? In the middle of what? Yeah, well, okay. Yeah, in the middle of an event, yes, they took her in the act of adultery, it says. But I'm talking here about in the middle of a place. They're in the middle of the temple, the holy place. They're in the middle of a crowd of people listening to Jesus teach, and also in the middle of what's going on, as you said, in the middle of a Bible lesson. Can you picture that? I mean, here we are. We're having a Bible study this morning. Can you imagine what it would be like? All of us getting a blessing from God's word and so forth, and somebody bursts in through the door and says, hey, look at this person. She's in big trouble. So that's the scene. That's what's happening. And verse 4, they say unto him, Master, this woman was taken in adultery, in the very act. Now, Moses in the law commanded us that such should be stoned. But what sayest thou? This they said, tempting him. So they got a problem here. It was not actually customary in those days for somebody like this to actually be stoned going through the legal process, but it was always possible. And so they're setting Jesus up. They didn't so much care about the woman. They did not so much care about the sin of adultery, if you follow what I'm saying. What they really cared about was putting Jesus in a bad spot, putting him in a situation where he had to answer. Is he going to contradict the law of Moses? Is he going to go ahead and agree with the law of Moses and say, yes, go ahead and stone her right in the middle of the temple? I mean, what's he going to do? It's going to be a tough spot for him. Whatever he says, it's going to be very difficult. It's going to put him in a bad light. But what sayest thou? Should we stone her? Or should we disagree with the law of Moses? Verse 6. You know, that's interesting, isn't it? And again, that's a cultural observation. And I think in these times, in this culture, it would be more likely for the woman to be in trouble than the man. Maybe to some degree kind of expected of the man, if you know what I mean. But the woman, she's really in trouble. It's an interesting point, though. If they caught her, as it says, in the very act, well, where's the man at? Just let him go home, right? Yeah, that's not necessarily part of my lesson this morning, but interesting, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, that's a fair question. Yeah. Yep. Where was I? Verse 6. This they said, tempting him, that they might have to accuse him. But, now here we pause for a suspenseful moment. What will Jesus do? What will he say? It's an awkward situation. He's just been preaching a wonderful message and the whole thing is stopped. And everybody waits while we deal with this situation. What's he going to say? But Jesus stooped down and with his finger wrote on the ground as though he heard them not. Now that's not the reply that anyone expected. Not the scribes and Pharisees, not the crowds of people with the interrupted Bible lesson. Nobody expected that. Somebody's expecting him to say, I agree with the law of Moses. Somebody else is expecting him to say, oh, I don't know. Well, where's the man at? You know, something like that. But no, he just stooped down and wrote on the ground as though he heard them not. Verse 7, so they continued asking him, what about this woman? He lifted up himself and said unto them, he that is without sin among you, let him first cast a stone at her. And again he stooped down and wrote on the ground. And they which heard it, being convicted by their own conscience, went out one by one, beginning at the eldest, even unto the last. And Jesus was left alone, and the woman standing in the midst. When Jesus had lifted up himself and saw none but the woman... Are you picturing this in the middle of the temple? Crowds of people standing around, and he just says nothing for a few moments. He writes on the ground and then stands up, looks around. Nobody, the place cleared out. None but the woman, he said unto her, woman, where are those thine accusers? Hath no man condemned thee? She said, no man, Lord. And of course, that's interesting because no man could condemn her. The whole illustration here is there was nobody who was guiltless, who could set himself up as a judge and say, I'm perfect so I can condemn her to death. But look what Jesus says. And Jesus said unto her, neither do I condemn thee. Of all the people in that temple that morning, there was one who could have condemned her. And he replies and says, neither do I condemn thee. Go and sin no more. Well, let's ask some questions about this passage here. In this passage, there's actually... Two crowds, as opposed to the individual. We've got the crowd of the followers, the people listening to Jesus' lesson, and then we've got the crowd of scribes and Pharisees who dragged the woman in. Would you say the crowd was a help or a hindrance in this particular situation? Okay, turned out to be a good illustration. Here's an interesting point. Did Jesus, we know that the whole lesson here is about Jesus ministering to individuals, but in this story, did Jesus minister to the crowd? Yes. Yes. In what way?
Well, their conscience has got the best of them, and we still don't know what he wrote on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Did he write their sin on the ground? And did he name them by name? You know, well, this is what you so-and-so, and this is what you did so-and-so.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Obviously, their conscience was activated, which is a good thing. That's what you want.
Right. Yeah, and it's a point that Bible scholars have discussed. What exactly was Jesus writing on the ground? And different people have different ideas about what Jesus was writing on the ground. But the fact is, John, the man who wrote the story, almost certainly was right there. If he wanted to tell us what Jesus wrote on the ground, he would have. So he intentionally did not tell us what Jesus wrote. But to return to the point, Jesus actually ministered to the crowd, and he ministered to them on an individual level, because each one of them individually was convicted by his own conscience, it says, and they went out one by one. So there was a ministry of Jesus to every one of these individuals. Every one of them had to pause and to think and to say, well, this woman appears to be in big trouble, but frankly, so am I. I just find it interesting, that's all. And how often in the Gospels you see Jesus actually does reach out to people who are opposed to him. He doesn't have to take time for this at all. The fact is, when the scribes and Pharisees bring the woman in, he doesn't have to address it in any way. He can dismiss the whole situation if he wants to. But he takes that opposition, he turns it around, he turns it into a lesson for everyone, and more than that, an opportunity to minister to an individual. Now, how about the individual here? In what ways does Jesus invest in her or minister to her? And there's more than one way. Multiple ways, I think, just in this short story. So you tell me, what do you think? In what different ways does Jesus invest in her? Showing mercy. Like I said, the one person there who could have condemned her said, I don't condemn you. Yeah, and that's remarkable, isn't it? We just have to think how often in our lives that the Lord is long-suffering with us in spite of all of our problems and resistance. He just helps us to keep going forward. Yeah. Well, that is what our conscience is for. Yeah. God doesn't want us to be guilty. If we are guilty, we need to know it, but God does not want us to stay there. He wants us to get that squared away and keep moving forward. You also see that God's not looking for vengeance. It's not vengeance that he's interested in, or revenge, or, I don't know, punishment. Okay, so mercy, long-suffering, we see that. Anything else? Yeah, he tells her to go. It's kind of like you say, hope for the future. Tomorrow's another day. This isn't the end of your life. You've got to keep moving forward.
So it's possible to be free from addictions. We don't have to keep sinning and keep doing the same things over and over because of our...
Mm-hmm.
That's just how we are.
Yep.
There's no hope for us, but there is.
Yeah, we don't get a lot of this woman's background. We don't get the whole story behind how she got to be where she is, but there's no excuse made for her sin. Even in the attitude of mercy and long-suffering, Jesus says, don't do it again. Sin no more. It's not helping you. It's not helping anybody else. It's not the life you should be living. So go, move forward, keep on, but do right.
They were really hoping that Jesus was going to really give her the one for,
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you know that old saying, it takes one to know one? You know, she just turned out to be a mirror for everybody. And I have to believe not every individual in the crowd was involved in the exact activities that this woman was, but it turned out that she was just a reflection of all of our problems. We looked at her and we said, well, I'm not perfect. I've made bad choices too. Yeah. Well, you mentioned Rahab. That's interesting. We've been studying the book of Ruth in our Sunday morning Bible studies, and Ruth over and over is mentioned and described as the Moabitess. She's the outsider. She's the stranger, the one who should not belong. And yet she's welcomed in. She becomes a part of the line of David and the line of the Messiah. And she was connected to Rahab. She ended up marrying Boaz, who was the son of Salmon. And Salmon was the husband of Rahab. Salmon was the Israelite man who married Rahab. And so right there in that family line, you see that how God's always taken the least expected people and making something out of them. I mean, David himself was the least expected, wasn't he? He was the last in the line when Samuel showed up to anoint the king. And he went down the whole line and he said, all these boys, they look great. Any one of these would make a great king. And God said, nope, none of these. And Samuel said, am I missing something? Do you have any other sons? And Jesse said, oh, you know what? I do. Ah, yeah, the little one. The one with the sheep. And that was the one God chose. There's a whole history of that in the line of the Messiah. I mean, a whole history. Abraham, where did he come from? You know, God called him out of a pagan society. And all the sons. God said, Jacob have I chosen, but Esau have I hated. Jacob shouldn't have been the one. I mean, Judah's family, Judah's line was cursed. But it ended up being the line of the Messiah. You just go down the whole thing. Solomon, he shouldn't have been the chosen son. Not by a long shot. He was the son of, what's her name? Bathsheba. So, okay, what were we talking about? This woman here? Yeah, how did Jesus invest in her? Any other thoughts? It's about time to wrap it up.
That's the story of Jesus' life and the story of our life, that he's given us another chance.
Well, he came to seek and to save the lost. He said, people who are whole and healthy don't need a physician. I didn't come to heal people who don't think they need to be healed. So the only kind of people that Jesus saves are people who are sinners. If you're not a sinner, Jesus cannot save you. And I guess that's the problem that the scribes and Pharisees had. They weren't getting any help from Jesus because they didn't think they needed it. Yes?
I was thinking he was giving her 1 John 1:9 before it was written. And then also I was thinking about how Jesus was quiet and that activated the people's consciences. And, you know, I'm sure that he was communing with his own Father. But sometimes, and I've been advised on this, that maybe you sit there and try to drill something into your kid, you know, to try to get the conscience activated. It'd be almost better to kind of like say, Lord, help this kid to really realize what they did kind of thing. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm trying to say? The conscience thing, rather than just sitting there going, on, you know, you shouldn't have been doing this, and you're, you know, that kind of thing. And maybe even in our homes or whatever, our spouse or something like that, there's certain times the Lord calls us to be quiet.
Well, that's a good point, I think, to conclude on. Jesus was, in fact, giving her 1 John 1:9 before it was written, because Jesus was himself 1 John 1:9, personally. And these scribes and Pharisees who were so interested in the law, they used the law for their own benefit. They didn't submit to it, they used it. And Jesus himself was the law. He was the fulfillment of the law. So what happened with this woman? Did she deserve punishment? Can you help me with that answer? Did this woman who was taken in the act of adultery, did she deserve punishment? They talked about the law of Moses, she should be stoned. Did she deserve that? Yes. Who actually took her punishment? Jesus did. He did, in fact, take this woman's punishment. He did suffer the penalty for her sin. He did. So whatever, you know, suffering that she deserved to go through, Jesus took that, and that's why he was able to say the things he said to her. None of these other people could help her. They couldn't condemn her. Jesus could condemn her. But because Jesus was the perfect Son of God and able to condemn her, he also was able to rescue her. The problem is these other people did not take her burden as their own. And I'll say that one more time so we can wrap up, because that's a good spot. Good spot to finish up on. These people could not help her because they did not take her burden as their own burden. Jesus did. And there we go. When we're investing in individuals, many times they do have problems, and we have to admit it. They're wrong. They are wrong. But we don't just cast them aside and say, well, you're suffering in your life because of your problems, so tough. We need to come to a point where we can take their burdens on ourselves and do something about it to help them. And in fact, we are living out the life of Christ when we're able to do something like that. Good. Well, it's about time to wrap that up. We still have a whole other section left. So at your table time this morning, you can do that last section if that's what we're doing today. Or we can also turn to the backside and take a little personal quiz just to see where we're at. Good. Well, thanks for your time. Have a good morning.